My name is Chris Sargent. I'm here representing Palomar Review Corporation. I'd like to reserve at least 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. This is a case that's an appeal from a summary judgment ruling by a bankruptcy court and affirmed by the U.S. District Court, finding that a statute of limitations on legal malpractice had lapsed prior to the signing of a tolling agreement that occurred less than 1 year after the appellee here had actually stopped providing legal services in the form of corporate and transactional advice. Heller's provision of substantive legal services after the critical date here, which was July 11th, 2007, both in the litigation, the community, and the corporate governance, preclude the grant of summary judgment in this dispute.
So post July 11th, 2007, what's the most significant provision of legal advice you say you're talking about from the Heller
Group? Well, there's the two different ways that Heller Irwin was representing peer review. There was the litigation with Cuity, and then there was the general corporate representation that went back to the very inception of the corporation. In the litigation loan, after on July 13th, Heller Irwin appeared in court in the Santa Fe Superior Court representing peer review.
Wait, was that the withdrawal to argument? Please let us out of this mess.
No, that was actually on a motion for preliminary injunction program, I believe.
Right? I'm sorry, I already moved to withdraw.
They had given notice of the next parte request to withdraw, but that hearing had been continued from July 12th to July 17th. So they appeared at that hearing. After that hearing, Heller Irwin prepared the proposed order on a temporary restraining order, not a preliminary injunction, and negotiated that Minnesota and acquired approval of that proposed order from the incoming counsel for peer review, who had not yet substituted Mr. Ackerman, as well as the counsel for Acuity, Mr. McLeod. And then they wrote a letter and submitted that letter to Judge McKinney on July 19th, which was after the substitution of counsel.
So do we look at the negotiation time, I guess, the negotiation of terminating, or the course of consideration of termination, or do we look at the time of the intent to terminate?
The test under the CCP, or California Code Civil Procedure 1040.6, is when how long did representation continue for, actual representation for. So the intent...
So again, does actual representation continue when the representing attorney say allowed?
Representation absolutely can continue after that. There's multiple decisions in the California Court of Appeal that have found so. We rely pretty heavily on the Gerkowitz decision, where after they had provided notice of withdrawal, they then worked on a memorandum of costs on appeal. They negotiated that with opposing counsel, and then that was submitted, and then there was a second notice of determination of the representation that took place. And the Court of Appeal found that the fact that there was an earlier notice of termination didn't matter when there was subsequent legal services that had actually been provided.
What do you say about the earlier determinations? Do you think those were actual notices that should be given validity?
In the Gerkowitz case, the lawyer sent a letter saying our representation has ended.
I mean, in this case, when there was a statement, I believe, by Mr. Hulk, I think it was saying that we intend to withdraw.
Well, one of the interesting things about Mr. Hogg's email, he doesn't actually say that Heller will not provide legal services anymore. What he provides is notice of an ex parte application of his intent to seek a withdrawal from representation in the litigation.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject just to clarify. In my mind, is it your position that the representation continues until the court signs an order that states that the representation is over?
The California courts have been clear that there's no bright line test, Your Honor. So the court signing the order of withdrawal is in of itself not necessarily the end of the representation.
So does that mean we couldn't give your client a partial summary judgment in effect and a ruling if we agreed with you? We'd have to remand it because of a fact issue to the trial court.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes. there's an issue about exactly which units. The California courts talk about this being an issue of fact that is normally not decided on summary judgment unless it's very clear that you have a strong set of undisputed facts. Here, I believe there are actually undisputed facts of acts of representation by Pereview after the critical date. The appearance at the hearing I just mentioned in the litigation, the preparation and negotiation of the order, are all classical kinds of activities that the California courts have found sufficient to find a continuing representation. There's also representations that continue to occur on the corporate and transactional side of this relationship after the critical date of July 11th.
It appears, though, that as a non-Japanese, you know, bankruptcy court, insists that there were a series of emails, I think around the 3rd of the 7th of July, that just included someone looking at these emails. Clearly, this relationship is there was no dispute.
First, the fact that they continue to actually provide legal services means that whatever the parties themselves may have believed at the time doesn't matter. What matters is whether or not services continue, substantive legal services continue to be provided after the critical date. The other problem with the lower court's ruling is that the documents that Judge Montali was looking at with respect to that time period between July 3rd and even up to July 10th were with respect to Dr. Marku in her individual capacity. And I would submit that he was improperly conflating Dr. Marku, who was at that time a member of the board, the CSO, and activating individually against security with Pereview, the corporation. And the perspective for the purposes of when the relationship ends is that of Pereview. But I don't think the court needs to even get there in this particular case because of the substantial litigation activities that took place after the critical date.
And what about on the corporate side post July 11th?
So on the corporate side, you have the email from Mr. Dow where he's working on the cap table, and this had actually been raised as an issue by Dr. Barker in an email prior to that time where she's just in discussion with Heller Irwin's litigation counsel. Hey, the capitalization table is a problem in this case, and this is in the record here. And then Mr. Dow emails Mr. Cloud, who's the attorney actually for Acuity, so it's a little, the context is a little odd, but it does show that he was providing corporate services on what was a pretty important issue. And the capital, the core, one of the core disputes in the Acuity litigation was corporate control. And capitalization, who owns much portion of the shares, is a huge issue for this to resolve.
I'm not sure it matters, because I know you're relying on heavily on the litigation side, but does that aspect of the corporate representation, is that came out of the language 340.6, it has to be specifically related?
Yeah.
The same specific, but I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, the same subject.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is that, with respect to that, because that sounds different from the whole loan.
That's correct. There is some distance between the specifics of the cap table and the overall disputes that were going on between Heller, between Pereview and Acuity regarding the notes and the failures that Heller Herman had with respect to the creation of those documents, as well as the activities that took place within the litigation. However, had Heller Herman provided an accurate cap table at the beginning of all of those issues, it would have simplified them. And then there were a lot of motions in the Acuity litigation around whether or not Dr. Barguia could exercise the rights as a shareholder, for example. And there was disputes on what percentage of shares that she had. So if there was an accurate cap table, I think that would have had an interaction with those issues in the litigation.
Seems like a stretch. Is there anything else on the corporate side?
There's also the preparation of the advice that was given with respect to the transition when Mr. Goodman left on July 9th and 10th, and the process of Dr. Barku becoming CEO as of July 13th. There was a corporate resolution prepared that lines up with the typical stylings of the Heller Irwin resolutions that had been prepared previously. And Dr. Barku sent in a declaration that Heller Irwin had agreed that they would help to make sure a shareholder meeting would take place after July 10th.
Well, what about the appeal? Was there, was, you know,
yes,
what was the thought about one of the questions in that
relationship. The appeal from one of the culinary judges, the person I'm not certain which of them it was, there were actually two in the Santa Clara Superior Court litigation. And there's an email in the record where, after July 19th even, where Ken Heller-Berman is discussing the process of withdrawing from the Court of Appeal status as counsel of record and whether or not to seek a substitution for Mr. Axelton to occur until July 24th. That substitution.
Okay, can I ask you if you're kind of paused, so I hate to interrupt your train of thought, but there is an email, the date of which I can't remember, in which it was after, I think, the other set of client came out, and maybe even after it was filed, the motion was withdrawn. It doesn't paraphrase, I can't remember the sentence, sorry. But they basically say, look, we need an accounting of every dollar we have a page of fees. And as a matter of fact, we want to know how much you're going to give us back. And that communication did seem to be the best on the underlying side. You see, even Paraview didn't think that this relationship was ongoing. And that was just kind of the end of the road, right?
Oh, well, the email that you're referring to, I believe, was actually sent by Dr. Barkin's personal counsel. And I think that there's another potential issue of conflation there, in that the lower courts inferred into that email that Dr. Barkin's personal counsel was acting for Paraview, but there's no evidence in the record outside of that one email that he ever had any representation relationship with Paraview. In fact, all of the other documents and records show that he was counsel for Dr. Barkin personally, alone, representing her interests as the majority shareholder in Paraview. And that email did not, there's a phrase
that was about the dispute also, wasn't it? It went back to the dispute between one of the companies, the CEO, I guess, at the time, said that she had withdrawn or resigned, and it says she was venting. Is that right? And so he says that, well, yeah, you resigned. I accept your resignation. And she says, no, I didn't resign. And she's really hiring a personal counsel to contest her status with the company.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. At the beginning of all of the litigation, right before all the litigation started, there was a dispute about whether or not Dr. Barkin had resigned as a CSO, not CEO.
That's all right. You can support the transition to be a quasi-representative for the
No, Your Honor, he was representing Dr. Barkin's interest as a shareholder in Paraview. So to the extent that her interests as a shareholder were aligned with the corporation, yes, there would have been arguments made that would have been a benefit to Paraview, the corporation. But he was never counsel for Paraview, the entity. And it's just demonstrated by the history of the substitutions here. There's no temporary period where Dr. Barkin's counsel was representing the CEO, went straight from Heller-Erman to Mr. Ackerman.
Hi, counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject, would you like to save a little time for because at least as one judge here, I would appreciate hearing your perspectives in a short form after your opponent has stated their first sale in your position.
I would like that very much, sir.
Okay, very good. Why don't you sit down, we'll hear from your opponents, and I'll be back up.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Marjorie Manning, and I represent the appellee, Heller-Erman, in this matter. First of all, to address Judge Gould's question, I do not believe that there is a single disputed material fact in this case. What there is a very heated dispute over the legal effect of the undisputed facts. And
you're saying that there are no disputed facts about whether the emails as found by the bankruptcy judge that they've been in to the representation. And the reason I ask you this is because of all the emails from Mr. Hall. You said, you should understand that if a curator does not make, does not, in the near term, dismiss Fairview from the pending Santa Clara County action, I expect that Helen Berman will seek to withdraw as counsel.
Excellent.
In that action, possibly as early as next week. And then it goes on to say if she believes that she has a legal basis that she should request another counsel. So what I'm saying is, words like if, near term, expect, will seek, and possibly, how those determinative words, when it comes to saying there's a definite end to a relationship as far as counsel
are. I believe those are two different emails.
If this is one of them, how do we...
There is an email that says you should know that if Acuity does not dismiss Heller from this litigation, we may well move to withdraw as early as next week. There is a subsequent email. In fact, there are two subsequent emails giving at least two, if not three, giving notice of withdrawal, intent to withdraw, and there are at least two emails postdating the one you're talking about.
Who were those sent to?
They were sent to Laura Barkhout and Mr. Russo.
And the personal attorney?
He was initially...
She was not a CEO at the time, right?
He was initially her personal attorney, but then he took on the mantle of demanding that certain actions be taken on behalf of Fairview. And by July 9, 2011, he had the same day Lutnick resigned, the same day, or the day before, Lauren Barkhout appointed herself CEO. He actually filed on behalf of Fairview application for TRO and preliminary injunction to stay the Acuity scheduled foreclosure sale. So Mr. Russo became more and more and more and more involved as time went on.
I understand what you're saying, but what does that create? Of course, the fact is, what is the precise relationship? What is his role? What is his authority? Who is acting on behalf of the corporation? That's what the question is. My argument is there's an indication that there's a termination on the side of terminating, but is that important? Who it goes to? What it says? And in other words, how is the undisputed facts when I'm getting it? Isn't that really a question of fact? Is what all this means?
There really is no question of fact as to what the emails say, whether they were sent, whether they were delivered, who they were copied to. There is none. And the only question is, what is the effect of that under prevailing California law, which is application of undisputed facts to legal principles, which is the very essence of summary judgment, of course. So what I'm saying is, we might withdraw as early next week. It came. We are withdrawing. I'm telling Keller what to do as Ms. Barkhout's so-called personal counsel became, I demand that you take these actions on behalf of Fairview. And when Heller refused, again and again, in writing, Mr. Russo filed the document himself. So you can't very well say, gee, I really wasn't representing.
Mr. Russo doesn't decide of his own. Unilaterally, that he's representing Fairview, does he?
The point is, just to say as an introduction to this, all of those events that I'm talking about, every single one of them happened no later than, they were over by July 10. So they are, they render the claim time barred in and of themselves. No, he couldn't just appoint himself counsel, Mr. Russo. You are correct. But the point is not who technically represents the client under California law. The point is for purposes of tolling, as opposed to for purposes of the existence of an attorney-client relationship, looking at whether or not a reasonable person or entity, if you will, in the client's position would expect that further services will be provided. And also,
because if that is true, then they'll tolling.
Pardon me?
Because if the entity is true, that a person could reasonably expect continued representation, then they would toll the running of the statute. Is that right?
Not that person, but a reasonable person in that person's position. Well, in other words, it's a reasonableness standard, correct?
Yes, but I'm saying if it were reasonable, as you suggest, whoever was required to be, then that would toll the statute.
And, but under California law, case authority equates, and there's nothing to contradict this, equates being told, we will not represent you, with actual knowledge that the representation has ended. And overarching this reasonableness standard is the purpose of the continuous representation tolling provision once the client discovers negligence or malpractice, once that's on the issue. The purpose is to prevent the disadvantaged client from being duped by the attorney so that the attorney can run out the statute. The cases, every case that addresses this purpose recognizes when tolling, when the purpose for the rule ends, tolling ends. And here, what we have, less than 1 year, certainly before the critical date, we have peer review accusing Heller of malpractice. We have Heller saying, I'm out of here. You let me know if you consent. We have peer review saying, well, sure, for price. You bet. Give us back everything we paid you over the last 6 years or so. And give back all the stock we took even longer than, ago than that that we bought. Sure. The, as Judge Montali so aptly put it, the holding hostage email. We have that. We have Michael Ackerman on the 10th, July 10th, coming to a hearing with Lauren Barkow, who has appointed herself CEO effective immediately. And Mr. Ackerman advises the court, I am prepared to come in and represent peer review if Heller withdraws. And of course, Heller has already announced his intention to withdraw. Now, under Hensley, which is one of the key critical appellate decisions here, the client became unhappy with the attorney, went to a new attorney and said, will you represent me? And that attorney said, no, I can't, not until your former attorney substitutes out. And the appellate court said, bingo, there's the date. It doesn't matter that all these formalities remained to be inked and the T's crossed and the I's dotted. That was the date you acted. You, client, acted. And it doesn't matter what your attorney thought, and it doesn't matter, it doesn't even matter that after that, attorney number one, the would-be defendant, communicated with opposing counsel.
Well, then what if they continue to do work for the corporation as your opponent?
Well, with respect to that, there is not one piece of evidence in the entire record that indicates, nor is there a citation to one I might have, that indicates that Heller, specifically Attorney Thau, or even anyone else for that matter, gave Ms. Barghout advice on how to make herself the CEO. That's just made up from whole cloth. There's none.
What about the July 13th hearing? You're on a case law going on that. What do you have to say to that?
The July 13th hearing, much like the hearings that preceded it, was a hearing at which Heller showed up. But the arguments that were advanced by Mr. Ackerman. Mr. Ackerman submitted a declaration. We have cited it in our brief indicating he was appearing for Paraview at that hearing, number one.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could ask you a question.
Yes.
What the relationship between what a reasonable client would think about the representation and the particular conduct that your friend on the other side said to us that Heller did in court?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
What does the action, what's the relationship, if any, between the conduct of what Heller did in court and what a reasonable client would think about whether the representation continued?
The hallmark of continuous representation is an ongoing mutual relationship and activities in furtherance thereof. Heller went to that hearing. Heller, who had an obligation to assist with the transition, went to that hearing and Michael Ackerman appeared for Paraview. It's undisputed. It's in his declaration under penalty of perjury. So Heller shows up to assist with the transition. The reasonable client, who by now is Ms. Barghout, who has been accusing Heller of conspiring with Acuity to throw the whole lawsuit into Acuity's pocket, has Mr. Russo in the wings, Mr. Ackerman next to her, and has no reason whatsoever to believe that Heller is going to provide future services, in no small part because Heller has told her so again and again, not simply because of her status, but because, as Heller puts it twice, there are no facts to justify interfering with Acuity's rights in this litigation. That's what you want. You have to go find somebody else. And then last, we have Ms. Barghout, not as an individual shareholder, but by Russo's express language, as the, quote, CEO and sole remaining director of Paraview, unquote, consenting to withdrawal as long as Heller pays the ransom. So, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare, is what a reasonable person would view this as being. I guess here's my attorney that I've accused of conspiracy to his face. I've submitted declarations to the court accusing him of conspiracy. Certainly he's malpracticed. I've demanded back all the money that's ever been paid. And, you know, I've these other attorneys following me around to court hearings and filing their own motions from peer review. But, gee, I think Heller would just continue on as my counsel. It's untenable. And it's not supported by a single case. And Ms. Barkow admitted in deposition, those are precisely the terms on which I was willing to let Heller out and consent to withdraw. So, no public policy that underlies any of the published California decisions is furthered by the results that Paraview seeks here. Not a single one. In fact, it would make a mockery of the relationship.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, your time. You're over your time at this time.
I know I am. I apologize. Thank you.
So you're answering Judge Will's question this time. So let's give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Hear what you have to say in response.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would request the urge the court to skip the language of the statute here. The language of the statute isn't about what everyone was thinking at any one given time. Those are all factors at play to whether or not representation was actually continuing. And the best evidence of whether or not a relationship was actually continuing is that services continue to be provided.
Your opponent has just said that at that July 13th hearing, in fact, no service were really rendered. Yes, Heller showed up in, kind of informed, but in fact, the other lawyer that the doctor brought in is the person who made the argument or whatever. So, what do you have to say?
Mr. Ackerman wasn't there on July 13th as counsel for peer review. He didn't become counsel for peer review until July 17th. He was there as counsel for Dr. Barkow individually, like Mr. Russo, in anticipation of becoming counsel for peer review. So the record is clear that there's actually, the portions of the record submitted by Heller Ehrman, there's a declaration from Mr. Ackerman where he talks about having been appointed as counsel, not substituted in by Judge McKinney on July 17th. He wasn't there as counsel. That these aren't simply formalities. I think these are important facts about determining exactly when attorney-client relationships get established between these parties. And to go back to Judge Gould's point about, what would a reasonable client under similar circumstances expect when an attorney appears at a hearing and says they're going to prepare a court order and then does prepare a court order, submits that to opposing counsel, gets their approval on it, and then submits it to the judge all after the fact, I think it would be very reasonable for a client to expect services to continue to be provided.
So counsel's argument to the court that say that the one email that I pointed out, but then if you put all of those together, the series of things he said, there were two or three others that were more direct. How do you say that is a question of fact?
The question is a matter of inferences, Your Honor, and actually this is where if the court doesn't find that the activities that took place after the critical date were sufficient just on their own, and you're looking to what happened before the critical date, a lot of inferences have to be drawn about what these different communications mean. So, for example, the communications from Heller Ehrman we're talking about, Mr. Hawk, I think it was the one you were referring to, wrote a long email about how he cannot take instructions from Dr. Barkow. He can only take instructions from the CEO. And after which, when Dr. Barkow tried to appoint herself as CEO, not effectively on July 10th, she had every reason to believe that, hey, I'm the CEO now by his own email 4 days earlier. Mr. Hawk should now be taking my instructions, and now I can have Heller Ehrman on my side in this litigation. So I think that there are multiple inferences that can be drawn from those particular things, and it's against the rules of summary judgment to make those inferences in favor of Heller Ehrman instead of the non-moving party, Paraview.